Hi everybody. Hi Yoel. Welcome to our weekly More podcast, Management of Reality. And today we're talking about Charlie Kirk, like everybody else in the entire world. We are talking about Charlie Kirk. He kind of deserves it. Very important young man, a tremendous impact on the world, on the United States and the whole world. And yes. now his assassin is having a tremendous impact, because the aftermath of Charlie Kirk's assassination has been quite interesting and also hopeful. I think that the way Charlie Kirk's followers and admirers are reacting all around the world is evidence of what is best in Western civilization, and suggests that maybe Westerners are going to fight for the West. So anyway, I've been talking about this in several different podcasts. Different people have interviewed me about this, but I'm interested to know, what are your questions, Yoel? What are you thinking about?
Yeah, okay. Thank you so much, Francisco. Thank you, the audience, for watching us. And the first question is like the tragedy that happened a few days ago, which was the assassination of Charlie Kirk. What do you think about it? Like, what is your opinion? What is your view about the entire picture, the big picture?
Well, the human cost is terrible, because Charlie was a father, he was a husband, he leaves behind a widow and two young children. And well, my heart goes out to the family and, of course, to their friends. It is especially tragic because it's not just a young man who was a provider, a husband and a father, but in fact, a good man, a person who was doing something good for his country, for his Western civilization, who was injecting dialogue. He was betting on dialogue, right? He was defending what is best in the West, which is the values of the European Enlightenment, which produced modern democracy. So this was a young man committed to the view that the more you talk to your opponents, the better your society becomes. You know? And I think that he was teaching everybody a tremendously valuable lesson about what the spirit of the West is, because, you know, the most famous fact in political science, the most amazing fact in political science, is that two democracies have not yet gone to war against each other. That's tremendous. Democracies have fought wars, but always against non-democracies. Wow. Two democracies have yet to go to war with each other. And that's remarkable. Why? Well, because the democratic spirit is one of dialogue. So within a democracy, you're unlikely to have a civil war because you have a parliament. And the entire point of the parliament is that different views can produce representation in government. And in parliament, those who believe different things can have dialogue and talk to each other and negotiate their differences without killing each other, right? And internationally, the citizens of democratic countries have a lot of difficulty supporting that their own government should attack some other government. They just don't support that. Not if it's a democratic government with whom everybody presumes they can talk, you see? So you could say that the fundamental spirit and value of modern Western democracy is dialogue. And that's what Charlie Kirk was betting on. He could see that the dialogue was dying in the West. The dialogue was being killed by these woke ideologists who are totalitarians, really, because their entire culture is one of censorship and cancellation. And that's what you do when your arguments are very bad. When your arguments are very, very bad, and you can't think of how to win a debate with your opponents, so you mob them, right? You bring a posse to oppress them, to silence them, to fire them from their jobs, to make sure that invitations to speak are rescinded, or if they're not rescinded, that somehow the public pressure of mobilized antagonists effectively silences the speaker, right? If you're asking for safe spaces so that nobody says anything that might inconvenience you, and so on and so forth, well, that's a totalitarian culture, and totalitarians always resort to violence. So this was bound to happen. What happened to Charlie was bound to happen because it's been happening. We've seen their violence. We saw it when the George Floyd riots in 2020. And it's deeply contradictory, right? It's deeply paradoxical in terms of the discourse, because their discourse is always that they're against violence. This is what they say. They even say that speech is violence. So they want to restrict your speech because, according to them, many different things that you might be saying fall in the category of violence. So they don't want you to say this. They don't want you to say that, because they're protecting victims from violence. And then these are the same people who are now cheering the fact that Kirk was assassinated.
Yes.
When Charlie Kirk was making every possible effort to talk to them. He was traveling to university campuses and holding large events and asking those who disagree with him to prove him wrong. He wanted to have a dialogue with them. So the guy who reached out to the other side is killed. And then the other side, which has been complaining about supposed violence, is now cheering the fact that he was murdered. So I think. Yes, the human cost of Charlie's assassination is very great for his family, for his friends, for all of us who admire Charlie. It hurts us. Yes. It hurts us personally, because he was our hero for many reasons. But the aftermath of his assassination has proven to be an opportunity, because Charlie's followers appear to be entirely worthy of Charlie Kirk. We've seen these gigantic marches, especially in Great Britain. I mean, the march in Great Britain, of course, it's not just about Charlie. This is true. It's a march. It had been building up because as I'm going to share my screen now, we've been talking about this on Management of Reality. We had an article just a few days ago called "Did Islam Take Britain?" which I now have on the screen. And the point of this article was to make people aware of the Battle of the Flags taking place in Britain just last month. Okay, now it's starting to feel like old news because so many things have happened, but this was just last month in Britain. There was this Battle of the Flags where the different local governments in Britain were taking down the British flags as if British flags were something to be ashamed of. Some of them even said that it was racist to put up the British flags. It's crazy. And at the same time, the flags that were sacred, that nobody could take down, that were protected by the police, were the Palestinian flags in Great Britain. Not only is it a foreign flag, but it's the emblem of a terrorist entity, right? That of people that want to destroy the West, including Great Britain. But that was the sacred flag that nobody could take down. So this was very offensive for ordinary Britons. and the grass movements organized to buy lots of flags, lots of British flags, and drape everything with British flags. You know, the lampposts, the buildings, the windows, the everything. And it was dramatic. It was very exciting. Of course, the media wants to represent the people who are proud of Great Britain and fed up with jihadism. They want to represent them as racists, but they're not racists. They're just British patriots. Nothing wrong with that. There's everything right with that. And there's everything right with opposing jihadism. It doesn't make you a racist at all. So that was going on. And then Charlie Kirk gets assassinated. So what happened in Great Britain is that Tommy Robinson, who's without a doubt the greatest British patriot alive now, organized a tremendous march that doubled as a vigil for Charlie Kirk. And so the march is a nationalist march. It's a march in defense of Great Britain. It was perfectly peaceful. Lots of people waving British flags, some of them waving Israeli flags, and holding up Charlie Kirk's picture and remembering Charlie Kirk. And I think something like, some people are estimating that as many as 3 million people showed up. The estimate of the British police, though they didn't want to make it public, but the internal estimate of the British police is that it was about 3 million people. And when you look at the Guardian's aerial footage, which we have included in our last article on Kirk, this is our last article on Kirk, and we've included here the footage of the, so that's a photograph taken from that footage of the aerial view of that gigantic march. So let's take a look at the video for a second, because it's truly unbelievable. Take a look at this. I'm gonna make it full screen. Look at that. Goes on forever. How many people is that? They wanted to say initially that this was 100,000 people, but that's impossible. I think 100,000 people are the people we saw in the first square. Now look at this. Just keeps going and going and going and going. It's endless.
Wow.
How many people is that? I think the internal estimate of the British police is right. That's 3 million people. Look at that.
Wow. I heard that was the biggest for a long time in the history of Britain. That's right?
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen anything like this anywhere.
Wow.
The only thing that kind of compares is the Serbian rally in 1989 in Kosovo Polje. It was about, they said it was about 2 million Serbs. It looks even bigger than that.
Wow.
Can you believe this?
Wow.
So, So this was perfectly peaceful, okay? So these are the people that the other side keeps wanting to call fascists, right? They call us fascists because we oppose jihadism, because we are proud of the West, but we're not the ones shooting people. We're not the ones intimidating folks and forcing them to shut up and calling them names and so forth and assassinating. We're not doing that. This was a perfectly peaceful march. So I think that it is functioning as a demonstration that pierces through the propaganda of the controlled media, and a lot of people are waking up, it seems. So I've been seeing that a lot of Democrats in the United States are finally getting fed up with the left, and they're saying, look, I'm leaving the Democratic Party. I can't stand this movement anymore. I can't believe that so many people from my Democratic Party are cheering the fact that Charlie Kirk was murdered. You know, they can't believe it, and they're saying, "I'm done, I'm leaving," and that's moral revulsion. That it's they're not saying, "Oh, I don't agree with the policies of the Democrat." They're pursuing policies I don't like. They're not saying that. They're saying the left is looking evil to me. They're defending murder. I can have nothing to do with that. So they're leaving. I think that's highly significant.
I watched in the Congress of the U.S. how when the same day when Charlie was killed,
yeah,
the judge there said like, let's make a pray, right? Like, let's end with this and let's make a pray all together. And the Democratic part started to shout, "No, we're not gonna do that. There's no way." And like,
I'm kind of glad that they did that, because it was like they got naked.
Yeah,
they revealed themselves, and I think that's useful for the public to see that.
Yes,
it's very useful. I mean, they didn't want to have a moment of silence for a good man who was assassinated. Wow. Wow. What did Charlie Kirk ever do to them? All he wanted to do was dialogue. So they disagree with him? Fine. I disagree with him. There are things that Charlie Kirk said that I don't agree with. So what? Everybody can have their own opinion, and I don't have to agree with everything that everybody says. But if they're interested in dialogue, in having conversations instead of violence, then they're on my side. I don't have to agree with every position they defend, you know?
Yeah, and what you said before about debate and speaking, there's a very famous video about Charlie when a young student goes and takes his hat off, like starts to run, and the police goes after her, and he goes and tells the police his cops, no, don't do that, don't do anything, just let her. And he grabs another hat and he puts the same hat he has many, and then he goes and does his this amazing speech, which is his core, and he says this: when we stop talking, when we stop debating, that's when violence appears. We need to stop. We need to debate ideas in order to avoid violence.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely agree. And, you know, I just recently, we had a podcast where I predicted that civil war is coming to the West very soon. And I said that it was inevitable. I said it was inevitable. Excuse me?
You did it last week.
Last week. Yeah. Exactly. We just did it.
Yeah.
And I said it was inevitable, and that it was coming especially fast to Britain. You know, we said all of that. And the reason I said it was inevitable is that the jihadis want it. And there are many, many, many jihadis now in Europe. They're reaching critical mass. So the reason I thought it was inevitable is that, well, if the jihadis want it, if they're committed to it, sooner or later it has to happen, you know? And when that violence begins, sooner or later Westerners are going to defend themselves, and then you're going to have a civil war. But now I'm not so sure. Now I'm not so sure. Now I'm beginning to think, I'm getting a little more hopeful that perhaps civil war can be avoided. Because the kind of support that Tommy Robinson just demonstrated makes him the most relevant political figure in Great Britain right now. Nobody's more important than Tommy Robinson.
Well,
let me tell you, that's another great hero of the West. And Tommy Robinson has paid a tremendous price for defending the West. He's been thrown in prison several times. He's been beaten up over and over again. They've thrown him into solitary confinement. They've persecuted him economically, you know, financially. And he has not given up. And thanks to that, And thanks to the fact that Tommy Robinson has consistently defended the best values of the West, he is now the most relevant politician or political figure in all of Great Britain. He got 3 million people out into the streets. You know, you and I have never seen a crowd that big. So he can now be the kingmaker, right? Even if he doesn't run for office himself, if he endorses a candidate, that candidate has a very good chance of winning. So I think the political landscape in Great Britain has now been transformed. And people have now felt their numbers. What happens when people, this is why coming out into the street is really very important, because it allows people to see something that nobody can deny. When you see that video that we just played, but you can't deny the size of that crowd. And then you know that the people on Tommy Robinson's side are a lot of people, The woke pro-Palestinian crowd can't get that many people out into the streets. They've never done that. So to get the civil wars that we were predicting, you need the jihadis to feel strong enough. And they were feeling very strong until last week. Okay, they were feeling very strong. They were intimidating people all over the place. But now that 3 million people came out to oppose them, I don't think they're feeling that strong. I think they're scared. And what that means is that they won't start the war just now. I think they're going to wait. And while they wait, there is a chance that Tommy Robinson and his followers can throw this government out and elect a new government formed by British patriots. Of course, it needs a new party. I think there is a new party in Britain. It's called the Reform Party, right? I think there's a...
I'm not sure.
Let me just double check. I'm almost sure. But in any case, it needs a new party. And if they can do that, if they can elect a new party, then Reform UK is the new party. If this can happen, and if they fire the bureaucracy, because you need to fire everybody, basically. I mean, you need to clean house. Otherwise, the deep state just stays right where it is. You need to clean house. But if that happens, if patriots recover Western institutions first, then you can fight against jihad, because you've recovered the institutions of state. So you can reverse the process we were in. So what was happening in Great Britain up until just recently? First of all, the government was throwing in jail people who disagreed with woke, people who tweeted, you know, disagreements with woke ideology, or people who tweeted or Facebook posted or whatever, or made YouTube videos that were in any way critical of Islam or Muslims or whatever. They would immediately say that you're committing a hate crime. Policemen would show up to your house and they throw you in jail. Meanwhile, there's these Pakistani grooming gangs or rape gangs violating white British adolescents. And British authorities knew this was going on for a long time and did absolutely nothing. And the official story is they do nothing because they don't want to be accused of Islamophobia, bullshit. But the real reason, as we know, is that the British government, like other governments in the West, are jihadi governments. That's what they are, which explains why they have been importing giant populations of Muslims into the West. And they have been allowing the jihadi states to build mosques all over the West that have been indoctrinating and radicalizing these Muslim populations in Europe, right? That's all government policy. Angela Merkel, in the middle of the Syrian civil war, she said, let them all come in. We'll take them all. There will be no limit. She literally said that. We'll take them all. Millions of people came in. Millions of Muslims came. Most of them in very young males is what was coming in, not families. Young males in the age of recruitment to, you know, to terrorist organizations. The rape gangs were not being prosecuted. If this produces if we really are at a turning point that allows Westerners to take back their governments, then the monopoly of force of the state starts acting in the opposite direction. And now, instead of throwing people into jail for criticizing Islam, we'll throw the Muslims who are raping Western women into jail, right? And now you're starting to fight the jihad. But we need to get our governments back first, because if you try to fight the jihad while at the same time our governments are jihadi governments, forget it. We're going to lose. We need to take the governments back first, and then we can easily win. Then we can easily win. The problem we've been having is that our governments are against us. Our governments are jihadi governments. That's why they're supporting the jihadis against Israel. Otherwise, it makes no sense. If the jihadis are trying to destroy the West and Israel is fighting the jihad, Israel is on the front line fighting the jihad, why on earth would Western governments be supporting the jihadis against Israel? That only makes sense if the Western governments are jihadi governments.
That was a question that you had in the last podcast, where you pointed out that the white people in Britain and in all Europe, they need to fight two fights. One is the jihadists, and the other one is the aristocracy, the elite.
The ruling elite, the bosses. Elite. Yeah.
So which one is first? That was like the question you had, and I think maybe you answered there, but now we are affirming that answer.
Right. First, I mean, I had the same answer in that podcast. We have to take our governments back first.
Okay.
But what is also true is that last week I was not very hopeful that was easy or really possible. Now I think we have a real opportunity. A real opportunity.
So we need to do it now, I see, right? Like
we have to hurry up. Yeah, we have to hurry up, because the growth of the jihadi population in the West is rather fast. Traditionally, Western populations in the West have been declining quickly. We're not replacing ourselves reproductively. And that's a separate problem that we need to solve. But the more immediate problem is simply for the West to survive, to solve the reproductive problem. So we need to defeat the jihad first. And that requires, as a very first step, to take our governments back. And that will also begin to solve the reproductive problem, because our governments have been trying to destroy our reproduction. That's what all these gender ideologies and the COVID vaccines and so forth, these are all attempts to destroy the reproduction of ordinary people, of people who don't agree with the destruction of the West.
Going back to the first point you said about what happened with Floyd and what's happening now with Charlie, there was a nice video that I saw recently that it was the repercussion, the impact after the death of both.
Right. You should send me that. I want to see that.
Yeah. It was amazing, because in one, you see fire, destruction.
Yeah.
And in the other one, people just go with the flags very peacefully.
Peacefully, yeah. In total peace. So this is the great paradox of the official narrative, because the official narrative says that our opponents on the left are supposedly anti-fascists, and we are supposed to be the fascists, right? We are the fascists. We're defending the Jews against the people who want to kill them. That's what a fascist does. We are marching peacefully after they killed one of our heroes. That's what a fascist does. Meanwhile, the other side, the side that says that it's against violence, right? They're supposedly very concerned about violence, and they're supposedly to, they're anti-fascists is what they call themselves. That's, they even have an organization called Antifa so that they can say all the time that they're anti-fascist, right? And when this person, George Floyd, died, they immediately declared that a racist homicide, even though they had zero, there's still today, there is zero evidence that that police officer was acting on racist motives. First of all, the evidence that has come to light has convinced me, at least, that nobody has any evidence that he did anything incorrect. It seems that he was following the training that he got and doing everything according to procedure. And it appears that George Floyd died not because of what the policeman was doing, but because he was intoxicated with drugs. But there's certainly no evidence that this police officer was acting out of any kind of racist animus. He was arresting someone who was resisting arrest. He was arresting him for a legitimate reason. The guy was using counterfeit money. Why would anybody resist arrest? It's the dumbest thing you can do. The minute you start resisting arrest, you're asking for violence. Why would you resist arrest? Only people on drugs think that it makes any sense to resist arrest, right? If the arrest is illegitimate, you can always have your lawyer fight it out later. But resisting arrest against an officer who is afraid of people who resist arrest, because they are afraid, because they don't know what's going to happen, yes, and they are armed and they are trained to use violence if you resist, why would you do that? Anyway, it's an incredible contrast. It's an incredible contrast, and it's making a lot of people realize who's the real danger here, right?
I have the video here. It would be nice to watch it all together.
Yes, let's watch it. Look at all that destruction. And they didn't even know if it was true that what they thought about George Floyd had really happened. They didn't even know that. They were just eager. They were eager to destroy. That's what was going on.
Yes. You can see that. Like, yeah.
No, this leads me to a philosophical reflection on what the left is, because the left presents itself as the compassionate side, right? This is how they present themselves. So they're supposed to, the very definition of the left is, we defend victims against oppression. That's how you know that you're talking to a leftist, is that they claim to be defending victims against oppression. They're supposed to have compassion for the poor, for the little guy, for the victims of injustice, blah, blah, blah. But there is a there's a view of the left that says, no, that's just theater. What leftists really feel is resentment at other people's success. Okay? So the narrative is, we're defending victims against oppression, but the true emotion,
it's an excuse.
The true emotion is, we want to hurt the people who have more, which is not the same thing as defending those who have less. Now, what does history tell us about these interpretations? If leftists were really concerned to help the disadvantaged, then after their first experiments ended up hurting the disadvantaged much more than helping them, right? They would have recoiled in horror from those ideas because they had backfired, so they wouldn't do it again. Like, why would you do communism a second time? Why would you do it a second time? After the first time, after the horror of the first experiment, why would you ever try it again? It ended up hurting the very people it was supposed to assist. So why would you ever try it again? The fact that they keep doing it over and over and over and over again suggests that helping ordinary people is not really what they're about. They want to hurt the people they hate, which is not the same thing. Not the same thing.
Yeah, and that tells you a lot about them. Like, they have so rigid ideas. They cannot even... They have this idea, right? And you can confront that idea. You can debate with them. But this idea needs to be right. Needs to be right. So they just... Yeah. Justify it in every way. No, there must be a way that this is right.
This so they rationalize. Instead of reasoning, they rationalize.
Yeah, it's like, this is the truth, and this cannot be moved. So let's move around here. We cannot change this. This is a fact. Like,
it's not, in other words, their beliefs are not the consequence of, they're not a conclusion after reasoning. They're actually priors. They're axiomatic priors that will be defended no matter what.
Yeah, and most of these ideas, they do not come from them. It's from someone else. It's an idea that they heard on TV. It's an idea that they heard on social media. And that
they get them from school. They get them from the university. So they get them from their professors. That's where they learn all that, because university professors in the humanities and social sciences have been preaching cultural Marxism for over a half century now. So that's where they get it from. And it's a very authoritative source, because when you're a young person entering the university, you're very impressed with your professors. I mean, come on. I mean, the university is a cathedral of learning. You're so excited that you got in, that you're going to get to study in the university. Yes. You know that the universities are producing all the science and the Nobel Prizes and all this and all that, and your professors seem to know so much, right? And then they start telling you all of these culturally Marxist ideas, and they present these ideas as a moral advance, as the latest stage of the development of positive Western values, ethical Western values, right? And so it has a big effect on young folks, because the source has such tremendous prestige. So, and then the other main, let us say, pressure acting on your psychology is that you can see your classmates adopting this view, and you want to fit in. You've got prestige bias, you've got conformist bias acting on this. And before you know it, you're scared to disagree with what you learned, with what they taught you, because it would cast you out of the social group that you've already constructed around yourself. So it becomes very stable.
That reminds me that Charlie Kirk had said many times that universities were a scam. He was against universities, and
they are a scam. I think they should be destroyed. I think we need to start over. Starting over doesn't necessarily mean destroying the universities, but you would have to clean house. You would have to fire all of those professors, you know, but maybe you can't. So what should be done, I saw John Popola propose this the other day. It made a lot of sense to me. He said, look, it's certainly not fair to Western citizens that we are paying taxes that support those universities, because a great many of those universities are public. So they're taking our money by, because t- taxation is theft. They take your money at the point of a gun. The state has coercive powers to take your money from you. That's what taxation is. So they're stealing our money from us, and then they're using our money to indoctrinate us into these ideologies that hurt us.
Yeah.
That's completely unacceptable. So what John Popola said is, we must end public education. There should be no subsidies for public education. If people want to teach cultural Marxism, fine, but find your own money. Find your own money to do it. Don't steal my money to feed me propaganda. Yeah. Get your own money if you want to do propaganda.
Like, right? They're using the taxpayers' money to impose ideas that they are against. Like, they don't believe.
Impose ideas on the people whose money they stole.
Yeah.
So they're treating us like slaves. We are slaves. That's what we are. We're slaves.
Wow. Okay. So how do you see this going, Francisco? You have more hope now that you see these manifestations recently. Where do you see this going in the near future?
I do. I have more hope. I mean, I can't say that I'm very hopeful, because I know the enemy is very powerful. And we have been documenting the power of the enemy to manage our reality for a while now. And it is true that the enemy is very, very powerful. But you know what? The enemy was very powerful before. The enemy was extremely powerful in the Middle Ages. And they controlled communication in the Middle Ages, and they also controlled reality. And in spite of that, when people started reading the Bible, remember, the Bible in the Middle Ages was a forbidden text. It could only be published and read in Latin, which people didn't read. They didn't speak it. But when people started translating the Bible from Latin into European languages, and ordinary people began to read and listen to the Bible, they were transformed, because the Christian Bible is about 80% Hebrew Bible. So they were reading about the slave revolt. They were learning about the Israelite slave revolt and all of the laws that the Israelites were given to protect their new freedoms. And fight against oppression and so forth. That's really important. This is what transformed Europe. This is what began to radicalize Europeans to fight for freedom. It was reading the Bible. And there's no question that those governments, that enemy was incredibly powerful. And despite that, our forefathers produced the modern democratic world. They did it. So the fact that the enemy is very powerful now doesn't mean that they're going to succeed in suppressing us. It's possible that we can win again. If our forefathers could do it, we can do it too. We can do it too. Now, that doesn't mean this is not a dangerous moment. It's a very dangerous moment. As I was explaining in another podcast, the development of AI and robotics is presenting a tremendous challenge, because there's a threshold beyond which, there's a technical threshold beyond which the bosses won't need human soldiers anymore. You see, the armies today are made up of citizens in the West, not mercenaries, citizens. Citizens who, if the government says, hey, you must go fire on your brothers and sisters, right? You have to go shoot your brothers and sisters, there's a real danger that the soldiers will rebel and will in fact take the government if they get orders like that. So right now, it's not that easy to use these armies against the citizens. It's really not that easy. It might backfire. But once we cross the technical threshold, which is already on the near horizon, in which the bosses will no longer need human soldiers, right? Because an army made up of robots and computers can be managed by a very small number of technicians. And at that point, If you have an army that is entirely robotic, then you can give it any orders you want, and it will not mutiny. So this is the danger. The danger we're in is that we will not take our governments back fast enough, and that we will cross that technical threshold before we do that. If that happens, we are cooked. So there is a relatively narrow window of time in which we have to do this. It is an emergency for the West. And I don't know that many people have realized the problem in precisely these terms. So that's why I'm beginning to explain. I have a whole paper explaining this, but it's long and it's technical. It has to do with why freedom depends on the population being armed. I'm a defender of the Second Amendment because I believe the population needs to be armed to defend themselves from these bosses. But I don't think the weapons that ordinary people can have are going to be effective against an all robotic army. Therefore, it is important to take the government back before that threshold is crossed.
Well, that's powerful.
Yeah, it's a strategic quandary. We really have to hurry up. We have to hurry up and elect patriotic politicians who will really clean house if we want to save the West. And if we don't save the West, the whole planet is doomed. The only hope for the planet is that the West renews itself, because freedom comes from the West. Right? So if South Koreans have freedom because the West invented modern freedom, the Japanese have freedom because the West invented modern freedom, Indians have freedom because the West invented modern freedom. So if freedom dies in the West, it's going to die everywhere.
So that's a great announcement for all of you who are listening to Francisco. Keep listening to us. Share with your friends, share with everyone. And if you want to make a contribution to make this movement greater, to spread this word,
Oh,
yeah,
yeah,
let's
let's
show
show
them.
them. Show them. I'm going to share my screen. So let me see. So this is where you do it. If you want to contribute a donation to help us do more of this work, we really appreciate it. What you need to do is you go to managementofreality.com, okay, and you scroll down, or franciscogilwhite.com, it's the same thing, and you scroll down to donations. Actually, if you're going to do it in dollars, you want to be on the English page. Okay, that's the English page right there. So you go to donations, you click on that button, and we have all kinds of different options here. You can do a one-time donation, or you can do a monthly donation. We prefer monthly donations, of course, so that you support us for a long time. And here we have the different buttons that you can do for monthly recurring donations or for one-time payment options. And really, we really appreciate it. The more we get, the more we can do. As you can see, we've been expanding our activities, and that puts a bit of a strain on our resources. So if you can't give, it's okay. It's okay. Just then share. Then do a lot of sharing. But if you can give us a little bit, we really appreciate it. It's going to help us a lot.
Yeah, perfect. Also, what you said before, you're comparing this stage we are in to the Middle Ages, where we were oppressed by the elites also, and no one knew about the Bible, and they were translating it. So that was a big battle that we won then, and now we are in a similar situation right now. What I can see is that the left are like they're in this category that they mark every point, right? And one of the points is being atheists, right? Many of them
Being what?
atheists, atheists,
Oh,
atheists,
atheist.
right? Like I see this many times where against Charlie, many atheists were against him because of being a Christian.
Well, but
No?
I don't think so. I don't think the issue is necessarily atheism versus religiosity. To me, the issue is whether you agree or disagree with the values of the Bible. So you can agree with the values of the Bible while believing that the Bible was written by a human being instead of God. But if you think the values are good values, well, then you're on our side, right? So it's a question of what's your position with respect to the Bible and to the values of the Bible and the impact of the Bible and the Judeo-Christian tradition more generally on Western freedom. If you are respectful and appreciative and admiring of the impact of Judeo-Christian values and the Bible on Western freedoms, if you get that, then you're on our side. It doesn't matter that you're an atheist. So that's really the issue, I think. That's really the issue. It's respect for the Bible and for Judeo-Christian values that built Western civilization. And I know many atheists who feel that way about the Bible. They don't think God wrote the Bible, but they really appreciate the Bible and they appreciate the Judeo-Christian heritage.
Okay.
That's so what really matters.
You're saying that is the morality what's important. If they agree with you.
Well, yes, morality, but also the Bible. In other words, I think what keeps the West together is the Bible. It's the Bible. As I said, it was reading the Bible that got people out of the Middle Ages into modern freedom. That's what did it, because they started reading about the Israelite slave revolt and it radicalized them. It inspired them. So I think it's really the Bible. It's respect for the Bible and the impact of the Judeo-Christian tradition. You don't have to be a believer or be part of a church or a synagogue or any of that. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with that, of course, but all I'm saying is it's not necessary. What is necessary, I think, for the stability of a Western community that has a shared kind of cosmology and civilization is respect for the Bible.
Okay.
That's what's really fundamental. That's what's going to keep us together, I think, because the Bible is what built us. It's what gave us
okay.
freedom.
That's nice. That's amazing. I didn't realize that. So we can encourage everyone who is listening to this to read the Bible.
Absolutely.
It's very important. If you have a friend, a family member who hasn't read it yet, go and encourage them.
Yeah, if you don't believe in God, read it as literature. Read it as the most important book ever written, the most influential book ever written, with a tremendous impact on all of Western history. And therefore, if you want to understand the West, you have to be familiar with the Bible. So read it respectfully, appreciate it for the effect it has had on our lives, making us better, because what was in the West... See, the way to get this perspective is to just to study a little bit of history, because what we had before the Bible was classical Greco-Roman civilization. And the people running that system were such psychopaths that they thought it was entertainment to capture a slave and then throw him into the Colosseum so that a lion would eat him in front of you and you would cheer. You know, and that's where these people want to go back to. The people who are cheering the fact that Charlie Kirk was assassinated, they're going in that direction. Okay. The ancient Greco-Roman bosses thought it was fun. They thought it was fun to watch a human being get eaten. Okay. They thought it was fun to have two humans be forced to fight to death and to watch their blood and guts get spilled in the arena in front of them. They thought this was entertainment. That's what we had in the West. These were societies that were built entirely around external war, around killing foreigners, stealing their stuff, and bringing the survivors back to Rome and to Greece as slaves. That's what their societies were built on. And the Bible changed all that. So if you study a little bit of his history, you will gain respect, admiration, appreciation for the Bible. You don't have to believe God wrote it. You just have to understand that that body of law in the Torah and everything that came after is what transformed the worst, most psychopathic societies on planet Earth into the best, most compassionate societies on planet Earth. And that understanding can bring us back together around a common narrative that we can all be proud of, regardless of what we believe.
There's a question here, if you want to answer it. Ophir Yahav is asking, did Churchill was an eugenist?
Yes, Churchill was a eugenicist. He was a major propagandist. He was a major propagandist for the eugenics movement. And everything you've heard about Churchill is a lie. So if you're interested in Churchill, I suggest you go here to managementofreality.com. Oh, you would have to read Spanish because my book on Churchill is in Spanish. Sometime in the near future, we're going to have everything translated into English. But the title of that book is Winston Churchill, Who Was He Really? And what I document there, and by the way, this is not new documentation. it's all based on what his standard biographers have documented. It's just that I don't care about the official interpretations. I just look at the data. Churchill, yes, he was a major propagandist for the eugenics movement. His buddies in power in Britain and in the United States were all eugenicists. And eugenics is, in fact, the movement that produced German Nazism. So I look at Churchill's record very carefully, and I conclude that he is part of Church. The whole mythology of Churchill is part of the management of reality we were spoon-fed in school. And guess what? The author of that management of reality is Winston Churchill himself. Because Churchill wrote the history of the war that became the backbone of all historiography of World War II. And therefore, he got to tell us what the narrative of the war was. So anyway, I explained all of that in the book. But I will also be producing articles on Churchill soon on our management of reality Substack.
Winners write history.
Yeah, that's right. That there is no greater symbol of the truth of that aphorism that history is written by the victors than Winston Churchill, because he's the winner of World War II. And he wrote the most influential history of World War II.
Okay.
I think we need to close it. I just want to remind everybody, please subscribe and give us likes and do a lot of sharing, please. We need to grow the English language channel and reach a lot of people. So please do your part and keep coming back. We'll see you next Tuesday. I'm sorry, next Monday. Monday, forgive me. I'll see you next Monday. And thanks a lot for your questions.
Thank you. Thank you, all of you. And see you.